Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just, it's, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's MEAT plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. Today's the last episode of the winter season here at Heritage Radio. Actually, no, spring season here. We're going to go into the summer in mid-May or so. But today we're going to end the season with a bang because I have in the studio a wonderful guest. She is a multiple cookbook author. She's also the founder of Arthur Street Kitchen, and her latest book is called Family, a new vegetarian comfort food to nourish every day. It's none other than Hedy McKinnon.
Hi, Kathy.
Hey, thanks for for coming.
I'm so happy to be back in the at Heritage Radio.
Well, I'm so glad you came to Brooklyn. You came here from Sydney, where you started your company.
I've been living here a while. Didn't come that far today.
Right, yeah. No, that's awesome. Of course, yes. I'm glad that you are here in Brooklyn is what I meant, and brought your business here, your cookbooks here. This is your third cookbook. Yeah.
The first book, Community, is only available in Australia. So this is my second book in the US.
I love it. I love how decorative the naming is. Mm-hmm. Family.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of just like you're laying down the gauntlet. Like, this is a book for family eating.
Usually when I write a book, the first thing that comes to me is the title.
Mm.
And sometimes, like particularly with Neighborhood, my second book, mm-hmm. and my first book in the US, I didn't actually fully know what was going to be in the book, but I had the title. I had the title for months before I had the interior. So I'm kind of very big picture. You know, I take a theme, and my books are very story driven. So that's when I have a title, I know that's kind of the story that I want to tell. So
I am so jealous. That is so like awesome of you to like take it from such a high level and then translate all these ideas and thoughts into it. I don't mean jealous, but I mean, I do think it would be really fun to like just like come up with like these one words that really encapsulates what you're trying to get across. Like,
I mean, I think with Community, it was easy because it came out of a business that was in my community in Sydney. Mm-hmm. So I had a salad business and I delivered salads to my neighborhood for 4 years on my bike, and that's how I got started. And so that book was originally self-published, and it was just made for fun for the people in my community. So that's why it was called Community, and it kind of took on a life of its own.
Right, right.
So from that, I've been very lucky to have this, you know, rich storytelling kind of at my fingertips because it's all led from that book.
Got it.
And it kind of goes on ebbs and flows, and but it always kind of ends up as something that is very personal to me in mm-hmm. a way. And this book in particular is probably my most personal book.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you weave many elements of food philosophy into this mm-hmm. sort of seamlessly. Like, you don't spend a lot of time saying why it's vegetarian. Like, you don't, like,
yeah.
you know, say, like, it just kind of is baked into the DNA of this book and yeah. your everyday cooking.
Yeah, I mean,
like, you're not talking about, like, animal welfare or something
yeah,
like that,
I mean,
right?
That's not my particular way. I'm mm-hmm. very passionate about vegetarianism now. Mm-hmm. I've been a vegetarian for 25 years
mm-hmm.
and it is something I'm passionate about, but I want my food to be inclusive mm-hmm. so this is actually the first time a book has ever had vegetarian on the front
yeah,
page.
I see.
All my books are vegetarian, but my food is also very inclusive, and the people that eat it don't actually particularly think they're eating yeah. vegetarian food. So my mission with my recipes is to give people a lot of flavor. Like, I'm always chasing flavor mm-hmm. in everything I do, and inventive ways of using vegetables and legumes and grains to the point where you're not really even thinking about labeling
exactly.
the food. I think labels in food are very divisive. Mm-hmm. I think if someone hears that let's go to a vegetarian restaurant, sometimes yeah. it's kind of a turnoff for people. So,
right, it's like, oh, well, that's not for me or
yeah,
something.
Like,
yeah,
like I don't feel like being vegetarian tonight. So,
and likewise with your Chinese culture,
yeah.
That is blended seamlessly into the recipes in this book.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're not like this. You didn't say this is an Asian-inspired cookbook,
yeah.
let's say.
I guess, I mean, all my books have an Asian chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I started cooking, this is going to sound weird, but I found myself feeling more Asian.
Oh.
I mean, my parents are both Chinese. They immigrated to Australia my dad in his teens, my mom in her early 20s. So I grew up with a very Chinese upbringing at home. Mm-hmm. We ate Chinese food. We spoke Chinese. But then I was in Australia. So there was this kind of two cultures, two worlds. And I never cooked Chinese food or Asian food or used Asian ingredients before I started cooking salads.
Oh.
And salads is probably the most un-Chinese dish you could really come up with. But my mum would come to the kitchen and cook with me. And so she would she would challenge me to use Asian ingredients in my salads. So I'd be cooking something with Brussels sprouts and some, you know, kind of Western or Middle Eastern type of salad. And she would throw a bag of seaweed at me and say, why don't you use this? I think this would be great for a salad. So very early on, I started incorporating a lot of Asian flavors in my salads and using like very traditional Asian ingredients like lotus root and, you know, things like hoisin sauce and, you know, Chinese sesame paste. And so there was a lot of that influence from the very beginning, but that's because my mum was I used to cook from home, so she would be there kind of breathing down my neck. So this book has been, the recipes in here are a little different. They're more traditional.
Right.
Some of them are very strange dishes that my mom used to cook.
Like the lettuce soup?
Yeah, like she, I think it's an Asian mom thing where they spend hours cooking and then she would come to the table and she'd take a bowl of rice and say, I'm not hungry. And she would tip, you know, sometimes just boiling water, but often, you know, like every night she'd make soup.
Uh-huh.
So she'd put the soup in and then she might throw a few other things from around the table into that bowl, and that would be her dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be like five or six incredible dishes on the table, but she would have the rice in soup with a few, I don't know, like maybe some stir-fried vegetables or something.
Yeah.
So there's that, and there's like her version of the tomato and egg dish, which is a very traditional Cantonese dish, which being away from her and away from home is, it wasn't one of my favorite dishes growing up, but I remember she made it and it stood out because it was so strange. You know, like you're part Chinese, you know that tomatoes are not very big in Asian,
but
in Chinese cooking anyway. So this particular dish was so strange, and I always think about it, and I find myself looking for this dish everywhere when I go out. I found a few places in New York that have it, but it's easy enough to make at home. So
yeah, and I love how you write in the beginning that, you know, food, cooking for family is so tied to those distinct memories of your family.
Yeah, I mean, dinner was a big deal at our house. My mum really cooked. She was a homemaker. And she was an immigrant, didn't speak English. So she really kind of made her home her, like, project and cooking her project. So she did, she just cooked all day. It brought her such joy. When we were younger, we probably thought, oh, this is kind of tiresome. So much food all the time, you know.
Yeah.
But then we just now, looking back, I realized how seminal those moments were around the table. Like, it was so consistent, you know, like we had early dinner, 5 o'clock, because my dad rose early for work. And we'd all sit around the table, and it was loud and fast and boisterous. And, you know, she would cook all day, and we'd eat in 5 to 10 minutes. And she'd lament, oh, why do you guys eat so fast? But it's kind of like, you know, we'd eat, we'd get our bowls and take them back to the kitchen. But it was that consistency, it's so grounding.
Yeah.
And I think particularly now, the world is so crazy. You know, the world is, and I'm a different mother than she was.
You grew up in a different culture.
Different culture and a different world. And our kids are growing up in different worlds. But mealtimes, like just sitting around the table, is this act that can bring such stability to kids' lives and to my life too. I mean, I rely on that moment to sit down and catch up with my kids, because life, particularly in New York, is kind of crazy.
It is crazy. Non-stop. And so, you're a working entrepreneur and a mom and a cookbook author and all this, you know, writer. And you still, you know, have some great tips for making time, like 10 minutes to cook something.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got 10 minutes, and it doesn't need to be. I mean, this book is, the recipes are a lot easier using pantry ingredients, like a lot of tinned beans and, you know, like easy vegetables like broccoli, like things that are easy to find and don't require hours and hours of chopping.
Right.
I mean, the meal can be a cheese toasty. It doesn't really matter. It's really more the ritual of sitting and bringing that to your children, because I find that we all are so much more open when we're sitting together at a table, and you feel comfortable, you know. So you can find out a lot about people if you sit down at a table and share a meal.
It's true. And I love how you say family food isn't fancy or complex, like you just mentioned, but maybe come up with a few classics in your repertoire.
Yeah, it is about classics. I mean, I find myself use this book all the time. Like sometimes when I come home, like, oh my God, what am I going to make? I don't have anything in the fridge. I try and shop smart. Like, I try and always have some legumes in the pantry. So there's a whole page in the introduction that's all about 6 ways to use a tin of legumes. Like, I'm not even asking people to, you know,
follow a recipe. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you can just smash them up. You can pan frying legumes, like pan frying chickpeas is one of my probably staples. We eat a lot of chickpeas in my house now, and like pan frying them in like olive oil with heaps of spices, like whatever spices, like cumin, coriander, turmeric if you've got it, paprika, whatever you've got, just adds so much flavor. And the kids love it because
it's like
it's crispy.
And introducing those flavors to your kids from an early point, so that you can all eat the same thing, basically.
Yeah, I mean, my kids are good now, but it hasn't always been this easy. I mean, they're now almost 13, 11, and 9, so and also through this book, the other aspect of this book, which I don't particularly talk about too much in the book, is that through writing this book, our family now eats vegetarian at home. So my family have never been vegetarian, and so I used to cook several meals.
So your parents? Yeah.
Me, my husband, my kids. I no longer cook any meat at home for them. So I used to make a meal for myself and then add on some sort of meat, you know, addition, like a sausage or a drumstick or something.
Yeah.
And now these recipes have allowed me we can just all be vegetarian at home. These are, so the recipes are geared towards comfort food and like with particular ingredients and flavors that kids are comfortable eating.
Yeah.
Yeah, less herbs.
Less herbs. I think that was interesting that people didn't like this whole shebang of herbs for some reason. And it was just maybe too much.
And not only kids, like adults too sometimes don't love a lot of herbs. Like I would, in my previous books, I would use like 3 or 4 herbs in one dish. I love herbs, but I realized that, you know what, this could be like, say, like a shaved vermicelli salad with shaved vegetables. My kids would eat that, but if it's full of herbs, it probably is a bit of a turnoff for them. So it's just like having those little tips. Now I sometimes serve herbs on the side.
Yeah.
Because I can put them on because I love. But other people around the table might not love so much. Yeah. So little things like that make a huge difference.
That's so interesting to learn what you have, how you've evolved your cooking.
Yeah,
definitely. From the cookbooks.
Yeah,
definitely. And just life.
Yeah, and life.
Yeah. So, going back to your Chinese heritage, we were talking a little bit about how, you know, a lot of people have certain expectations when they see a Chinese person cooking. Have you come across like people being like, okay, where, I don't know, expecting a certain thing when they see you? But I know you've been in the business for a long time.
You mean expect like Asian dishes?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I started making salads, which is a very un-Chinese type of dish, I don't feel like people even associate me with being Chinese. It's a very strange thing. I mean, I probably would be called more Australian than Chinese, even though I'm 100% Chinese, but born in Australia. So I think I'm always trying to use it as an opportunity that... I feel like for me in food and particularly in Australia, I've never had boundaries. I've never felt like I needed to, you know, like break down stereotypes. I feel like I've never had those stereotypes. So realizing that, I use it as an opportunity to educate people about multicultural food and about all the different ingredients you can use to create a really simple dish. So I think food is such an equalizer and people understand food where they might not particularly understand politics.
Right.
Or it's very, you know, it's approachable and it's non-threatening. So in many ways now being in the US where cultural identity and being in touch with who you are and cultural appropriation and all those... The discourse around race is much greater in America, is much more evolved.
Than Australia.
Definitely. Uh-huh. I feel like in Australia you can't really even talk about it yet. You can't talk about racism and you can't talk about minorities as much as in America. And I find it's really freeing to be in a country where you can have these conversations. And so even though I'm not particularly political in anything I write, or my books are definitely not political, I just use my cooking and food as an opportunity to just educate people about all the positivity of having, of seeing the opportunities in a multicultural world. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to talk a lot about more and also your journal Peddler, which is a multicultural food journal.
Yeah.
But we're going to cut to a quick little commercial break and we'll be right back chatting more.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive Chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Akiko Katayama, and I'm the host of Japan Needs here on HRN. By interviewing fascinating personalities in Japanese culinary culture, I try to demystify Japanese cuisine. My guests have included sake brewers, tea experts, Japanese whiskey experts, and sushi chefs. You can find Japan Needs whenever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back chatting more with Hedy McKinnon. Her latest book is called Family. And you're also the founder of the independent food journal, Peddler, Exploring the Multicultures of Food. That word again has come up, multicultures.
Yes, it has. Peddler is a magazine. I think it's into its fourth, I say think, because it's gone so fast.
We launched started in 2017, right?
2017. Yeah. So the first issue was Chinatown. And I found myself thinking, I wish every issue could be themed Chinatown because I feel like I didn't even touch on. It's our first issue, and obviously the magazine's evolved too, but first one, I think it came out of, I think Peddler really is here because I'm living away from my family, like my family in Australia and my mom, and I find myself really sort of gravitating towards my culture a lot more. And we recognize, and being away from home, I really recognize the things that I find I miss the most are just like little small moments from childhood or a little memory, like making dumplings with my mum or just hearing or smelling her hands, which I always smelled of ginger, or the sound of the exhaust when she was cooking, the
very
overhead.
Sensory, yeah,
just very sensory and very like small moments. So I really wanted to create this magazine about home cooks and about those small moments.
Yeah.
So the stories in there are not, they're not investigative. They're not huge explorations of a theme. They really are very small moments that...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
It's a very, very... it's very personal to a lot of people.
Right.
And even if that you're from a different... What I've found is even if you're from a different culture than the culture you're reading about, it still resonates. People, the reaction has been so strong and emotional, and, you know, people email me and tell me about, you know, crying when they read stories, or it reminded them of their grandmother,
wow.
or they read it aloud. I've got this one couple that reads aloud to one another. So it's just filling us this gap, I think, and this, I think right now in the world, people are looking for these small comforts, and I think you can really find that in the food. So, so the first issue was Chinatown. The second issue, which I didn't bring today, is childhood. And third issue was a single ingredient called rice. Because rice we found was, we couldn't find one ingredient that was more... you know, like a staple in more cultures than rice.
I know.
And so that was a really fun issue. And the next issue actually, which is out in, I think a few weeks, is called, is the theme grandma. So,
oh, perfect.
Yeah, they're grandma stories. It's pretty exciting.
I
that
can't
one's going to be incredible.
The photography is so beautiful.
Thank you.
And I love that there's just, you know, one photograph of ginger against white, or like, you know, and
it's,
then atmospheric ones.
Yeah, I mean, the photography was something very, it was a deliberate move to have very quiet photography too. Like, you know, I think in food right now, everything's very loud, particularly with social media. You know, you go on and everything's very bright colors and
in your face,
and close crops, and it's just very overwhelming sometimes for all the senses. So what we wanted Peddler to be is very quiet, almost muted colors. It's like take a step back and just rest for a moment and enjoy the story or enjoy the recipe, because there are a lot of recipes in Peddler. It's recipe driven. And to an extent, having done Peddler really influenced family, because it influenced the photography in the way we shot. Like, we have a particular way of shooting some of the stories in Peddler, which is almost like bird's eye view, like over a shoulder, or it makes you feel like you're part of
room.
You're in the room. So it really it actually influenced the kind of art direction of family.
For me
personally, it did. It was my whole kind of look for the book.
And this was by Louisa Brimble,
Louisa's,
she came on the show for the Wild Cookbook.
Yeah, so Louisa's one of my best friends. And
really?
We have worked together on... So we shot Community together before I was an author and before she was really... She was just starting out in photography then.
And now she's a James Beard nominee for the Wild Cookbook.
We've got everything crossed for her. So we're so proud of her. She's
awesome.
She's come over twice to shoot my books. So both Neighborhood and Family were shot in New York.
I love how, like, this photo right here, you can see the translucent mung beans.
Yep.
Through the light in the back.
And the steam.
And the steam.
So all our food is shot, you know, in real time. Really, there's no waiting around. We shoot so fast. Louisa, we have fun too. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's like we're very unconventional cookbook shoots. For Family, on our first day, we shot... And if you've made a cookbook, you'll know. This is pretty unheard of. We shot 22 recipes in the first day, which was about a third of the book.
Okay.
And we just worked so fast because we were setting up tables and it was shot like you were eating dinner. So it was an incredible way of shooting a book. And we wanted it to be like food in motion. Like this is really happening. It was not really even styled. It was styled to the extent it was put in a bowl, but none of the table scenes were really styled. It was
I noticed that there's this dog and then there's this stack of random books on the table.
Yeah. It's just very real life. And that's what I wanted the feel to be. Mm-hmm. So,
because it means something.
Yeah.
It's not like about the presentation. You know, you're right that, you know, this whole style of cooking is not trying to be fancy or...
Yeah,
trying to be
absolutely. I mean, I'm a home cook. I don't call myself a chef. Even though I've been in commercial kitchens before, it's very important to me because being a home cook has certain connotations. But for me, they're all positive.
Mm-hmm.
Like none of the connotations of calling someone a home cook are negative. For me, it's a compliment because home cooking is so rich. And there is so much to be learned from the elders in the kitchen. And for me, like my mum's the biggest influence on me.
And she wouldn't call herself a chef too, would she?
No way. No way. I think home cooks are, for me, they're the heroes because they're the ones who are putting dinners on the table every night. And it's a very different world to the chef world, but it's... no less demanding. And, you know, there's a lot you can learn from home cooking. It's just all the flavors and just all the little techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because when you cover home cooks, most of them are women.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the world that I'm kind of embracing and celebrating.
So what if somebody didn't grow up in a household where the mom cooked or where any parent cooked or where anyone cooked?
Yeah. How
should they start to build some traditions and memories? And
We've met, especially through Peddler, we've met a few of people and there's some stories coming up about people that didn't grow up with food or where a family breakup has, you know, kind of meant there's no more home-cooked dinners or beautiful lunches to take to school or whatever. So I think that's what I try to do with Family is really the story of Family is keeping it really simple and not... I think guilt, there's so much guilt in food. Like there's bad food, there's good food, there's, you know, like the whole
indulgent.
And then this is your, you know, diet day or
sensible.
Whatever. Yeah. I think just keeping things, you know, there are some, I think just actually valuing mealtime is a good place to start.
Okay.
Is just actually seeing the worth in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, I think cooking, I've met a lot of people who don't cook for dinner, and I think just keeping it really simple and not trying to be a chef from the very first day and then finding, like, as you mentioned before, like a repertoire, you know, building those things into your daily life, like picking up
your favorites.
Yeah, your favorites and things that are non-threatening. Like if your kids love pasta, then make pasta twice a week, mm-hmm. but maybe make it with a sauce that's a little bit more interesting than just red sauce. There's a pasta pasta night chapter in family. Yeah. So they're just sauces. And like I'm sure that some of them would be too intimidating for children maybe, but there's some fun ideas in there, like a cream corn dressing,
mm-hmm. I love that.
A tahini dressing, but it's kind of mixed with some peas. And I mean, my kids really love it. It's creamy, but it's not cream. So it's a bit of a healthier take on comfort food.
Okay.
There's a pesto that's like a roasted tomatoes with walnuts.
Yeah,
so it's just a little bit of a different take on something that's a classic.
It sounds like your mom was a little crafty too with some ingredients. She used tomato sauce to create sweet and sour sauces.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's been that sauce is wonderful. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's ketchup with like apple cider vinegar and mm-hmm. some tamari or soy sauce and
super
garlic.
Easy.
And
it's so everyone easy. Has that at home.
It's delicious. Uh-huh. And you know, I serve it with like a ramen noodles. And I do this cauliflower that's in a chickpea batter, but you could just roast the cauliflower or you could just do the ramen noodles on their own.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just think keep it simple. Don't try and be a chef overnight.
Uh-huh.
You know, keep it really simple. There's one soup in there that I've heard a lot of people really love. It's just a pearl barley with chickpeas and lemon.
Okay.
And some kids love lemon and some adults love lemon. I love lemon.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's a really quick pantry meal. It's ready in about, I don't know, 15 minutes or something. And just always keep challenging yourself
mm-hmm.
By bringing in like one element that's a little bit different. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. And I love how you have so many cultures in here. I mean, we didn't get through all of them, but you have a Korean silken tofu stew.
Yes.
Tons of pastas. There's a Gruyere pudding.
Yes.
Bread pudding.
A lot of those are influences of, I mean, we grew up in Australia. Australia's very multicultural food-wise. We are very advanced and probably ahead of the world in the way cultures are incorporated into just everyday eating. Like a normal cafe will have all your za'atars and harissa and all those flavors without being branded a Middle Eastern cafe.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just a normal cafe on the corner. So that has been a very big part of all my books. So people might say, oh, why do you cook all these with these Middle Eastern flavors? It's because I grew up eating these flavors just mm-hmm. at my local cafe. But then there's a lot of influences from being in America too, is like Korean food. It's not something I ate a lot of
mm-hmm.
in Australia. And I now am fairly obsessed with Korean flavors
because
I feel like I didn't know Korean food until I came to New York.
And then there's also a chana masala from
Chitra. Yeah. So there are, I think I call it the beating heart of this book is those family stories,
right?
Which from people around the world,
and their families.
Chitra Agrawal from Brooklyn Deli is one of them, where she shares her great aunt's chana masala. And there's also, you know, a range of stories from other families. And with the common language of how important family cooking is and what family cooking means to different families across mm-hmm. the world, because I thought that was also very important to show across cultures, food and the act of eating together is a fairly... It's the same across all cultures.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that you've done such a beautiful job of bringing these stories together.
Yeah, they're very special.
It's very story heavy, as you were
yes.
saying. I love it. Well, it looks like that's about all the time we have for today. But, I mean, we could go on forever.
We could.
I just hope everyone gets to cook from this book and read it and absorb it. It is called Family from Prestel Publishers.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
It is beautiful and it is it's going to last a long time, I'm sure, because there's so many recipes in here. But thank you so much, Hetty, for your time and for joining us today for the last spring episode here.
Yay.
On
Thank you so
Yards.
Much for having me, Kathy. It's a
All
real
right.
pleasure.
Yeah, happy spring, everyone, and we'll see you in the summer for Heritage Radio Network.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, good radio supported by you. For freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.